I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. How's this for self-help advice? You're never going to sort out your life the way you want. You'll always have too much to do and not enough time to do it. You're never going to be sure about the future. You will disappoint other people. You will experience regret about things you've done and not done. Trying to control reality will not bring you peace and prosperity. That's taken from Oliver Berkman's new book, Meditations for Mortals, about how embracing our limitations, not overcoming them, can lead to a more meaningful existence. Berkman wrote a popular psychology column for The Guardian and discovered that self-help rarely works. His message is, learn to celebrate our imperfections and the unpredictable messiness of life. He draws on philosophy, psychology, literature, religion, and his own life to push back against the message of relentless self-improvement, productivity, and control that is so popular today. His previous book, 4,000 Weeks, was about the illusion of trying to manage time. Oliver Berkman, nice to have you with us today on The Connection. We have a lot to talk about.
it's a great topic, the human condition. You can keep it going for a while.
Absolutely. Reading about you, many people described you as a self-help guru, but having read your book and even describing some of what's in your book, do you see yourself that way?
I mean, no, but on the other hand, I don't protest the label too much. I think that the instinct behind self-help, right, the desire to find some answers to this stuff and find ways to build a more meaningful life is totally noble. Not all the responses that are given to it in the self-help industry are quite so noble, but I don't think there's anything wrong with the desire. That goes way back to sort of, you know, ancient Greek and Roman philosophy, really.
Well, I could use some improvement, that is for sure. But in picking up on what you just said there about the sort of industry that's part of the self-help movement, I've always felt that if self-help actually worked, there would be no self-help industry because we would take the advice and we would have better lives and we would move on from there. As someone who has immersed themselves in this world, what drives it? What keeps it going?
I mean, I think you're right. There is this this phenomenon, isn't there, where I suppose what you really want if you're the promoter of a self-help philosophy is for it to be a little bit helpful, but not too helpful, so that there's a reason to come back for more and more of it. And I've been, in the course of my reporting for earlier books, you know, to these kinds of huge motivational seminars, which really do leave you feeling pumped up, but only for a few days. And it's essential that it's only for a few days, because then there's a reason to come back and go to another motivational seminar. I think also, though, it's worth saying, I don't think it's only kind of bad faith on the part of people in the self-help sector that leads to this phenomenon. I think change and changing ourselves is really hard and often quite slow, and it involves a lot of kind of iteration and coming back around and hopefully sort of spiraling ever deeper rather than just going around in circles. But, you know, it's difficult stuff. So one of the reasons that quick fixes and magic bullets don't work is that's just not how we work.
And it's as you said, it is hard to change oneself, one's habits. You do describe to some degree your own struggles with yourself. You describe yourself, and maybe it's true today, as a productivity geek. You also said you were an insecure overachiever, which to me feels like almost the worst of both worlds. But how, you know, did any of this advice, did it help you in any way?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I think it's really important to be honest and upfront and say I come at all of this as somebody who is at least partly totally fascinated by and susceptible to the allure of self-help. I was, specifically for years, I was kind of really deep in trying to find, yes, productivity systems, ways of organizing my to-do list and my time and my projects in such a way that I could do more and more and more and would never have to drop a ball or disappoint anybody and could realize all my ambitions. And still today, you know, I hope we'll talk more about this. I don't think of this philosophy that I'm exploring these days as being antithetical to wanting to change or being ambitious, wanting to create interesting and important things in the world. I think it's actually a more sustainable and reliable way to get there. Because the whole problem with too much investment in change and in the idea that there's some magic system out there that will do it for you is that you end up, spending your whole life looking for that instead of getting on with the things that could have helped you build a meaningful life. So it's really actually counterproductive to what it claims to do quite often.
And you seem to say that for too many of us, the goal is some degree or some definition of perfection, which of course is impossible, but that having that goal really takes us down a wrong path. I mean, it focuses on productivity, on getting stuff done, but does it really bring us what it is that we want?
Yeah, I kind of quite deliberately try to sort of explode the definition of perfectionism to make it much broader than I think we necessarily usually think of it. So certainly the standard kind of perfectionism that says, I've got to produce work that meets an incredibly high standard of merit. But there are lots of other kinds of perfectionism. I think actually the compulsive worrier is a sort of a perfectionist because he or she is trying to get a kind of total certainty about what's coming next, what's coming down the pike and isn't going to achieve it. People pleasing, I think, is a kind of perfectionism because it's that desire to have sort of perfect security about what everyone else is thinking, especially about you, you know? So in all these different ways, I think you can see these things as these kinds of absolutist demands for a kind of control, a kind of security that maybe we just don't get to have as human beings. And it's from that sort of widened definition of perfectionism that I can then sort of introduce my notion of imperfectionism as the counterpoint to it.
Yeah, and I do want to get to imperfectionism, but just picking up on what you just said is also, I would think that the sort of, if the goal is perfectionism, then we might not take a risk because we're afraid of making a mistake, is that we kind of inhibit ourselves because we feel we're going to be wrong, and to be wrong is to be bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a good way of putting it. And yeah, procrastination very, very often, perhaps always, is some version of not wanting to take the next step out into the world of reality where things are never perfect. And there is sort of no better way to cling on to a fantasy of how perfect your novel or your screenplay or your relationship or anything is going to be than never to launch it, you know, than never to do anything about it. You get to sort of hold that fantasy close and it remains pristine because it's completely inside your mind. And as soon as anything gets out into the world or takes on real reality, it's just inevitably imperfect and fall short of that.
In fact, you write that successful people, which I would think is some closer definition to perfection, are walking anxiety disorders.
Yes, that's not my quote originally. I'm quoting their Alec Wilkinson, I think, the entrepreneur who says that, you know, what looks like great success from the outside is on some level just a kind of strategic handling of your incredible anxiety. It's and that this notion of insecure overachievers that you brought up, I always get such a ripple of recognition when I use that phrase in, you know, public events or anything like that, because I think so many people who are driven and successful and sort of celebrated perhaps by other people for what they've accomplished are doing it on some level to kind of fill an inner void or to try to reach some sense of being adequate human beings who have justified their existence on the planet, you know? And I'm really interested, as someone who has definitely felt that acutely, I'm really interested in whether it's possible to be ambitious and high achieving in a different and healthier way, I suppose.
Or being a secure underachiever.
Well, I think underachievement is fine too, if you're fine with it, right?
Exactly.
Exactly.
<It's> like, Well, let's talk about imperfectionism, because that really is one of the main messages of this book, which is that we need to, accept our limitations? Flesh that out for us.
Yeah, I think it is about accepting limitations. I sometimes use the phrase embracing limitation because I'm trying to gesture at this notion that it's actually a kind of stepping into ourselves. It's not a kind of resignation a stance that says, like, well, hey, you can't do everything, so you might as well not bother trying to do much at all. It's actually the stance that really, you know, says, what if we, and this is what I think imperfectionism is, this is what I would define it, it's the stance that begins from the understanding that there will always be too much to do, that you will never feel fully ready for any new work project or life stage, that you'll never feel like you have the security from terrible things happening in the future that you might wish you had. And like, what happens if you kind of accept that at least a little bit and then take the next step? And to me, anyway, there's something incredibly empowering and liberating about that, right? About sort of letting go of that impossible struggle and looking at what you actually have in front of you and where you actually are, and thinking and asking yourself, like, what is the next step I could take here? Not on this kind of endless and agonizing journey towards this supposed future state when I'm going to be finally secure and certain and know what's going on and understand how to be a parent or a spouse or all these other things that are so endlessly bewildering
and demanding.
But what can I do now? And I think that's the shift for me.
Does it allow us then to live more in the present rather than always have our eye on the future?
I think it does. You know, I think there's a lot of pressure put on that concept of, you know, being in the now. And there's that phenomenon that people are probably familiar with, where if you really try to be present in the moment, it's a terrible recipe for being present in the moment. When you have a newborn baby, everyone tells you that you should savor the early months and years with a new child. And then if you're me anyway, you catch yourself thinking, like, am I savoring this enough? Like, I need to savor
you
harder.
And me both.
Right. And this does not work. But what I think is so powerful about what I'm calling imperfectionism, that stance of accepting limitation and starting from that limited place, is like, you don't need to be berating yourself about being present in the moment. You just more naturally are, because you're no longer so frenetically chasing this future moment when you've figured it out, when you've sorted your life out, when you've mastered being a human in the modern world. You're just looking at what you have right here and what the next step is that you can take.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Oliver Berkman. He's got a new book, Meditations for Mortals. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with columnist Oliver Berkman about his new book, again titled Meditations for Mortals, 4 Weeks to Embrace Your Limitations and Make Time for What Counts. He says, as we just heard right before the break, that we should embrace our imperfectionism, maybe let some of our goals slide, do less, not more. We might feel better, and paradoxically, we might even feel more productive. Oliver, let me read the very beginning of your book here. Day one, it's worse than you think, on the liberation of defeat. The most liberating and empowering and productive step you can take if you want to spend more of your time on the planet doing what matters to you is to grasp the sense in which life as a finite human being with limited time and limited control over that time is really much worse than you think, completely beyond hope, in fact. And I thought, boy, that takes guts to begin a book telling people, you know, forget it. But I know your message is way beyond that. But it sounds like you have to really push back on the sort of belief that we have that we can fix things, that we can do better, we can, you know, get closer to perfection.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, I'm always trying to make this kind of two-step move and say, you do have to accept a kind of defeat here when I think you when you turn towards the what it really feels like to be a human, which is that, you know, we are always going to be able to think of countless more meaningful things to do with our time than we're ever going to be able to do, and impossibly higher standards than we're ever going to be able to attain. But the second step is that if we can release a bit of that, that's when we can really do things. That it's this is the kind of defeat that is empowering and leads to more success and more accomplishment, because it's then that you are free to, you know, focus on a handful of things that really matter to you, that make you feel more alive, instead of constantly postponing the sort of real meaning of life to this future point when you've finally got your arms around everything. There's a Zen teacher, she was a British Zen master called Hoon Ju Kennett, who I quote in that chapter, who said that her way of teaching students was not to lighten the burden of the student, but to make it so heavy that he or she would put it down. And I still get goosebumps when I think about, or right now, you know, recite that line, because for me that gets very close to what we're talking about here. We are trying to do something impossibly difficult when we spend our lives trying to not feel the fullness of what it is to be a limited human, and it's you can get a spring in your step again from putting that down, at least to some extent.
And by limited human is that we have, if we're lucky, 4,000 weeks on the planet, which was the title of a previous book of yours, that we have a finite amount of time and we're never going to get everything done that we want to get done. But that weirdly and paradoxically sort of frees us to do what needs to be done. It's a curious thing.
I think that's right. And yeah, not just finite in a quantitative way, although that's definitely very real, but also, yeah, limited control, limited knowledge. I mean, just limited understanding of the other people with whom we live our lives. You know, it's like never quite being able to figure out what makes even those we're closest to tick, and never having any kind of certainty about what the future holds. And yet seeing, and this is important, I think, that if we did have that level of certainty and security, there's a sense in which it would be awful, right? Mm. I mean, it would be a kind of death to be totally certain of all these things. If you enjoy watching, I don't know, soccer games, pick any example, you might desperately want your team to win, but it is only because you don't know if they will that it's that it's interesting in the first place. I think deep, intimate, personal relationships kind of depend on the fact that there's something mystifying about the other person, that you haven't completely figured out every aspect of how they work. And you can extend this same idea to countless different domains. There's something about not having that control that is important for the meaningful quality of life.
I'm going to quote you again. You say the greatest achievements often involve being open to serendipity, seizing unplanned opportunities, riding unexpected bursts of motivation. But, you know, control is so attractive, right? Even the illusion of control just feels, it makes us feel as if we're secure somehow. But we live with deep uncertainty, as I think we all know, but maybe struggle against.
Right. I mean, I think it's really interesting to notice that at least in most of the time, and in most senses, the control that does make us feel so more comfortable is almost always just out of reach. You know, it's like it's not that you have it right now, it's that if you really stay on top of things, you will have it. It's if you really kind of, you know, once you finally do X or Y or Z, or even just in a couple of hours, you know, once you get to the end of the working day and you've got those things out of the way, then you'll be able to take a breath, because you'll be in control. And so it's constantly kind of leading us forwards in this sort of illusory manner. And yeah, I think it's true on the sort of global and national and international scale as well. We're always, C.S. Lewis said this once very eloquently, as you might expect, you know, humanity has always lived on the edge of a precipice. It's just that, you know, we can go through whole stretches of politics and international affairs not being able to ignore it, and then suddenly we can't. But it was always true.
It's interesting to talk about this when there is such a premium on things like, you know, grit and stick-to-itiveness, and that if you're, you know, a mature person or a striving student, you know, you're not going to give up. You're going to keep going and going. But I feel like you're really offering something very different from that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, firstly, one of the problems with something like grit is that to some extent, these are just sort of personality traits that are unevenly distributed, right? And if you happen to not have that, then it's difficult to know what to say. You could develop it, I suppose, but then don't you need grit in order to develop grit? And it goes on forever. I also think that for a lot of people, maybe not everybody, but I do think the kind of people who are more likely to be interested in what I write, it's almost more deferring gratification too much is almost more of a problem, you know, being too persistent at things and thereby never quite getting to the point in the present where you're kind of actually enjoying life can be more of a problem. You'll know, and listeners will know, obviously, about the famous marshmallow studies where allegedly, it's kind of been a bit disputed since, but allegedly, if you were able as a kid to look at a marshmallow and patiently wait 10 minutes until a second marshmallow was given to you, then this is correlated with all sorts of great positive life outcomes. And if you're so impulsive that you just grab the first marshmallow when you get it, the opposite is the case. As I say, lots of dispute about what that really means anyway in social psychology, but also, just to continue the metaphor, like at some point in your life, you've got to eat some marshmallows. Otherwise, there's no point accumulating them. And to be sure, there are probably lots of people who do need to get better at deferring gratification and not acting on impulse. But the kind of people who are really interested in it from a personal development point of view are probably, in my experience, already too far in the direction of deferring gratification. So if you're the kind of person who consumes self-help advice on, you know, how to do things that your future self will be proud of, you know, maybe it's time to start thinking about your present self a little bit.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Oliver Berkman, our guest today on The Connection. He's got a new book, Meditations for Mortals, 4 Weeks to Embrace Your Limitations and Make Time for What Counts. He has a previous book came out just a couple of years ago called 4,000 Weeks, which is about the, as he describes, the terrifyingly short time that we have on this planet. Going from that to something pretty mundane, you say instead of to-do lists, and I have to confess, I do to-do lists, and I feel very good when I check them all off. You say that can be a trap, but there are done lists that might, and that, these are your words, done lists that might be more helpful to us. Again, describe what you're saying there.
Yeah, I'm certainly not against to-do lists. I think of this more as a complement rather than necessarily an alternative or a substitute. A done list is, as it sounds, like a list of things that you keep to which you add the things that you accomplish during the day. So it's a list that gets longer during the day as you do things. I mean, to-do lists also tend to get longer during the day, but
yes,
they're not
do.
Supposed to.
Exactly.
And, you know, I suspect if you're an aficionado of to-do lists, you might admit also to the behavior of sometimes writing something down on the to-do list that you've already done so that you can cross it out. And if anyone who knows the pleasure of that is in the market for a done list, because really what you're doing there and what you're doing in a done list is creating this record of what you did do already to sort of shift the focus that we so naturally have otherwise, which entirely is about comparing what you've done today to what you could in principle have done, or that what is still left to do. But that is basically infinite. And if you compare your productivity to an infinite list of possibilities, you're never going to end up with a positive judgment of yourself. Whereas I think that done list sort of implicitly compares you to zero. It's just like, what if I, this is the what I have done and what I wouldn't have done if I just stayed in bed and not done anything.
And
So
not done
it can be
anything.
really quite powerful, yeah.
I think related to this is something you call the efficiency trap, how being efficient, taking care of tasks, those to-do lists, actually ends up leading to more tasks. There's something like a loop that gets started.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is just, I'm not saying I never fall into this even today, but it's really clear that if you, especially on the individual personal level, you know, if all you do to try to deal with being overwhelmed and having too much on your plate, if all you do is try to fit more things in to the same amount of time, then all else being equal, what's going to happen is you just get busier and busier and busier and more stressed. The classic example, of course, is email, right? You find yourself with too many emails, so you think to yourself, okay, I'm going to get on top of this now once and for all. Spend a good few hours answering emails. I'm going to start responding more quickly. And all that happens is you just get way more email because now you have to, you know, people reply to you and then you have to reply to those replies and you get a reputation for being responsive on email. And before you know it, you're busier with email than you ever were. It's a little bit like that phenomenon where they add a lane to a freeway to ease traffic congestion, but then the additional lane makes the route more appealing to more drivers, and so more cars come, and in some cases anyway, the congestion just ends up just as bad as it was because the route has been made more efficient, but the supply of cars, as with emails, is essentially infinite. And if you go faster at getting through an infinite supply, you still don't get to the end of it.
And of course, social media is all designed to keep us connected, to keep us hooked. Guilty of doom scrolling. I don't know about you over there in England, but, you know, it's so easy to just sort of go down that terrifying rabbit hole.
Yeah, no, there's plenty of doom scrolling goes on in the UK as
it's
well.
It's a worldwide phenomenon, I bet.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that a lot of people understand this now, but I'm not sure we sort of live and behave as if we understood it, is that social media in general is that the whole way that works is that it is a giant machine for figuring out what compels your attention the most and then feeding you all of that, regardless of whether it's what you want in some other sense of the word, want to be spending your time reflecting on. And it's another reminder that, you know, we talk about time being a finite quantity, but it's really attention that is the most consequential fine aspect of our finitude in a way, because at the end of your life, as I put this in 4,000 weeks, you know, at the end of your life, what you paid attention to in your life will just be what your life was. If there was some problem you had and you never paid attention to it, it's kind of debatable whether you really had the problem. And the same would go for, you know, positive aspects of life.
And finitude, as I mentioned to you before we went on the air, that's a new word for me, so it might be a new word for our listeners. But basically is that we don't have a lot of time, so we should make the most of what we have. I mean, in a nutshell, does that describe finitude for you?
I think so. To me, this word just means, you know, finiteness, the state of being finite. It's just the fact that it is just an non-negotiable fact about us that we have all these, that we are limited in all these ways. And I think it does mean make the most of what you have, but there is a version of that message that can be very stressful. You know, it's like, okay, life is short, I've got to cram every moment, every day with extraordinary activities and you know, in order to sort of really wring the most value out of it. And I'm really trying to push back against that as well and say, actually, we are so finite. There is such a big mismatch between all the things we can dream of and the things that we'll have time for, that you can sort of let yourself off that from that stressful version of it. You can say, look, I'm swimming in this infinite ocean of possibilities, of demands and obligations, of good causes that could use my help. So all I have to do is pick a few that really make me feel alive. And in many ways, that's a much easier recipe than the alternative.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking too of people that, you know, frankly don't have the kind of privilege of choice that I think we're talking about, that for them life is a series of demands. They have two jobs that don't pay enough. They have kids. Mm-hmm. They live paycheck to paycheck. They have no time. All they feel like they have are limitations. How does this help them?
You know, it's definitely true that there are circumstances where this is easier news to stomach than others, and that, you know, on a relative scale, it's easy for me to say. I think it's still, in certain important ways, universally true, at the same time as being easy for me to say.
Sure.
So, you know, if you are being asked to do an impossible amount of things in your life, then you're not going to do them. Because that's what the word means. And if that has sort of very, very grave consequences, then those are the grave consequences that are going to unfold. And it can only help, I think, even in that situation, to get better at staring reality in the face, right? Not to at least not to be complicit with the impossible demands, and to drive yourself completely insane in an attempt to meet them, but to see that actually we're all having to make these choices. What will I do and what will I neglect? It's just that in certain circumstances, the consequences are the stakes are higher. There's also this kind of aspect that I think comes really from existentialist philosophy that says there is a sense, and I say this, it's a sort of I say it tentatively because it can be misinterpreted, but there is a sense in which you always have a choice. There's another sense in which you don't, and in which bad mm-hmm. self-help is always telling you, yeah, just choose to be a millionaire and the money will manifest itself. But there is this existentialist sense in which, you know, if you're working in jobs that sort of wipe you out and that don't fulfill you in an
office. You know,
themselves.
Oliver, hold on, only because we're up on our break here. I will pick up on that after this very short break, talking with Oliver Berkman. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and if you're just joining us, Oliver Berkman is our guest. He's got a new book called Meditations for Mortals. And for a number of years, he wrote a popular psychology column for The Guardian, discovering that self-help rarely works. And this is a kind of unself-help, self-help book that draws on existentialism and spirituality and psychology and literature and his own life to offer an alternative way to think about how to live in the world under all the pressures that so many of us feel. Let me pick up on what you were talking about right before the break, where you were saying that, in a sense, we, as human beings, we all do have a choice. I mean, I would argue that some people have more choice than others, but nonetheless, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just trying to unpack this notion that, yeah, I associate with the existentialist philosophers, that there is always in a certain sense, there is always a choice. If you are, to give the example we were discussing, you know, if you're working two jobs that you dislike and you're doing it because that is the only way that is open to you to provide for your family, if it really is the only way that is open to you to do that, then, like, that's why you're doing it. You could make the choice in principle, of course not in reality, but you can make the choice in principle of not supporting your family, of walking away from the jobs and suffering all the grave economic consequence of that. And in seeing that you could do that, but you are not doing it, like, that's where the meaning of your choice lies, right? It's like you have ended up in a much less fortunate and privileged part of the matrix of reality than you otherwise might have, and the value, the meaning, which is supporting your family, is the thing that powers the choice that you make. Now, it's really easy and would be very dangerous to sort of say, well, and therefore it doesn't matter that we live in an unjust society where some people are in that situation. But on the individual level, seeing that, you know, you can make any, you can make a choice, you could bear certain negative consequences if you made one choice, you'd bear other ones if you made the other. There's a level of kind of commitment to, like, oh, this is why I'm doing this, right? These are the values I stand for, which are doing the best that I can do in my situation for my family or whatever else the ultimate value might be.
You have a chapter, You Can't Care About Everything, on staying sane when the world is a mess, which it clearly is. And you quote a French philosopher, Raymond Aron, is in the parks with his wife. It's a beautiful day. And he runs into a friend who, Simon Weil, who says, because he clearly is upset about something, Aron says to him, so what is wrong? And he says, there is a strike in Shanghai. And his tears were, you know, his eyes were brimming with tears, and the troops have fired on the workers. I think many people can relate to that. You look around the world and there are terrible things happening in this world. And one wants to care about that, but do we have a limit, I guess, for our empathy?
Yeah, I think we do. And I think the reason that anecdote is so powerful, it was the philosopher Simone Weil who he was meeting in the park. And I think that there's something admirable about having that level of total openness to all the world's suffering. But I couldn't function in that way.
Could
function in that way, right? And I think especially we can't do that in the modern world, because we live in this situation that, you know, we're made more aware of more suffering and more crises than the greatest saints in history would ever have even heard of, right? And imagine being just any ordinary person in medieval times. I mean, all sorts of problems with that lifestyle, but with that existence. But you just wouldn't have known about most of the things that were unfolding around the world. And now we do, and it overwhelms us because we're just not designed to get our arms or our hearts around that amount of suffering. So I make the case in the book not for therefore just shutting out the news, not for sort of ignoring the wider world, but for understanding that it is okay and permissible to sort of pick your battles, and not only permissible, but probably the only way to make a real difference. To say, like, here are these 10 things that I see, or 100 things that I see through my screen that are sort of crying out for my attention, or my volunteering, or my campaigning, or my philanthropic donations, and I'm going to pick one or two. And it's not because I've determined that the others don't matter. It's not because people aren't suffering in agony in the other contexts. It's because I'm finite and I've got to choose something if I'm going to make a difference.
You also have a chapter, Don't Stand in Generosity's Way, on the futility of becoming a better person, which is interesting in a, you know, so-called self-help book to see a chapter with that particular title. But it does kind of turn self-help on its head, saying what, we're probably good enough as we are.
Well, this is a sort of nuance that I love so much. It comes from the meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein, and he says that his personal practice is to seek to act immediately on a generous impulse when it arises. So, you know, if he feels that he wants to send a note to somebody to say how much he appreciates them, or he feels that he wants to give some money to somebody who is begging for money in the street or something like that, the practice is to try to act on the impulse. What I love about this is that we kind of make ourselves miserable, I think, trying to become more generous people, or some of us do anyway, you know, to change our personalities so that we're nicer in some way. And what this practice is saying is, like, well, no, maybe the problem is not that you're not already generous enough. Maybe it's just that we sort of stand in the way of that generosity. We say to ourselves, okay, I'll write that note when I have some proper time to give it the focus it deserves. Or we say to ourselves, actually it's much more efficient if you care about homelessness to give money to organizations that are fighting homelessness, which is true. But I have lost count of the times in my life when I've sort of felt that generous urge to help someone out in the street and then thought, oh, no, I should channel that money more effectively. And then you just don't do anything,
yeah,
right? Because life takes over and you've got 1,000 things on your to-do list. So I think that this idea of just like, just can we get a little bit better at getting out of our own way once the natural kindness arises, instead of trying to sort of engineer ourselves into being, becoming more kind.
I mean, that is what you're saying is very simple, which is when you feel this act of generosity, do something about it right then and there. Don't put it off. I mean, that's, you know, highly practical, if I can put it that way. But as you say, you know, life intervenes, and sometimes we just don't know, well, what is the right thing to do to help somebody?
Right, absolutely. And that's a whole other kind of manifestation of our limits, isn't it? That you just don't actually know what is the right thing to do. I think, and this obviously applies in kind of life choice settings as well, right? Do I take this job? Do I stay in this relationship? Do I move cities? There are countless examples of this. And I think, I've got some sort of specific tools and techniques in the book, but what they all really add up to is there is, firstly, a lot of benefit in learning to trust intuition a bit more here. There is lots and lots of detailed cognition going on kind of outside of our conscious access to it. Intuitions count for something. If a certain direction in life leaves you feeling like it would be the path of growth, and you can't really say what that means, but you can feel it, that there's a lot of information in that. And then also there's just the fact that there's a lot of occasions in life where the very fact that we're so limited in our knowledge means if you don't know which of two options to take, just take one, you know, flip a coin almost.
And just do it, to quote a company.
Right. Do something.
Do something.
Take an action. Yeah.
What is scruffy hospitality?
This is a lovely concept which comes from a pastor from Tennessee called Jack King. Who, along with his wife, he writes about realizing that, you know, he had developed this whole checklist of things to go through whenever they were having friends around for dinner, so that it would be quite elaborate to make sure that the lawn was mowed and the playroom was cleared and everything was cleaned, and they prepared a really amazing spread for their guests. And then realizing that this was actually preventing him or dissuading them from inviting people around because it was so much work. And so this notion of scruffy hospitality, which he opted for instead, is to, you know, invite people into your home as it is, to cook them things based on what's in the cupboards right now, and all the rest of it. This is not just about dinner parties. I think it's important to say there's a general attitude to there's an attitude to life here which says we put a lot of effort into building these facades. They kind of take so much effort and anxiety that they distract us from what really matters, which is, in this metaphor, you know, having good conversation and closeness with friends. And even more than that, there's actually something that forges a much deeper connection when you let that facade fall. You know, to be invited round to somebody's house and it to be a bit of a mess is almost to be invited into their real lives in a more direct way than to, you know, be the audience for a performance of how tidy their home is and how lovely their cooking is.
You tell a wonderful, it's an old Jewish joke about a rabbi who's on his deathbed, and he's surrounded by his students, and they, you know, they want to know the meaning of life. And he says, life is a river. And they, you know, repeat what he says, life is a river. And then one of the students says, well, what does the rabbi mean by life is a river? And they go back to the rabbi and they say, what do you mean by life being a river? And then he says, all right, so it's not a river. which I thoroughly enjoyed as a joke.
Yeah, I love it.
But there is a message there, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, for me anyway, one should never overinterpret a joke, and maybe right. people have other interpretations. But right. for me, what the rabbi is hinting at in the shrug at the end, you know, all right, so it's not a river, is all these kind of ways in which we try to get a hold of reality through conceptual means, you know, to try to say, okay, what is life like, or what is going on in this situation, or anything else. There are all these kind of ways in which we're trying to achieve the feeling of control, which we were speaking about earlier, through kind of getting a mental handle on what's happening. And ultimately, I think lots of traditions, lots of religious traditions, I think above all of Zen Buddhism here, but I think Judaism and many others point to it. Ultimately, like, real life, the fullness of life escapes those concepts. It's bigger than that. And that there's a lot to be said, even on very practical day-to-day levels, in developing the willingness to sort of do things, step deeper into life, without having first figured out, you know, whether it's a river or a mountain right. or anything else.
Or not a river. I mean, I must say, as I get older and frankly a little closer to my own death, I do feel, and this is almost a cliche, but I do feel the preciousness of life and the preciousness of relationships. I mean, I think and I get sad because, you know, I don't want to lose any of that, and yet it does make life feel more worth living.
Oh, that's interesting. And I'd be interested to know. I mean, I think there's a certain kind of sadness which is in denial, and I'm sure this is not the one you're talking about, but I just want to draw the contrast. Sure. Like, there's a certain kind of sadness which is in denial, which is sort of indignant that this is how it should be. And I think we probably all do have some of that, right? Because it is such an insult, the fact that mortality is such an insult to who we are as humans. But there's another kind of sadness which I always feel is probably best described as poignancy, and which, again, a lot of kind of Japanese philosophy and thought seems to be very specifically very eloquent about, that kind of sees that there's something so sad about the fact that time slips through our fingers and that life comes to an end, but there's something in that sadness that gives it its kind of quivering, vulnerable value, you know, that makes it that makes it so much more profound, and that it wouldn't be the same if it wasn't transient, if it wasn't passing by in that way.
We're almost out of time here. I want to quote something from the very end of your book, and it says, if you found this book in any way inspiring, you may be tempted at this juncture to resolve to make a fresh start, to declare from today you'll do everything differently forever. This is an urge worth resisting. It's a perfectionistic attitude towards imperfectionism and a recipe for disappointments. We have about a minute here, Oliver Berkman, but you're saying, you know, Don't take this book to heart and turn it into your life.
Well, and fresh starts especially, right? We all want to do this. We all want to say, oh, great, I liked some new ideas I encountered, so now I'm going to do everything differently from here on. And then you either don't, or you do for a few days and then fall off the wagon and hate yourself. It's so much more powerful to do a little bit of the things that matter to you badly for 10 minutes, with no faith that you're going to come back to them necessarily tomorrow or the next day, but just to actually do a little bit of them today.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Oliver Berkman, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And thanks for writing the book, which is titled Meditations for Mortals, 4 Weeks to Embrace Your Limitations and Make Time for What Counts. As I mentioned earlier, he wrote a book a couple of years ago called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals, and a previous book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. Well, that's it for today's edition of The Connection. Thank you so much for joining us. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. And The Connection is produced by Debbie Bilder, along with Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us as well.